Mr. Chairman, on behalf of my colleagues, I first thank all of you for your ideas, your suggestions, and I must say again this year, I think I can claim bipartisan support for MFA. The post-World War II international order actually is historically an unprecedented phase in global history. And generally, the last 80 years have been a period of unprecedented peace and prosperity for most countries in the world. But the point is that it was unique. And the deeper point today is that that international order has ended. This order used to be characterized by principles of multilateralism, international law, sovereign equality, free markets, global supply chains organized on the basis of efficiency, and global institutions, the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO. In the last 60-plus years of Singapore's independence, actually, we evolved exquisitely to take full advantage of this global system. And we benefited from Pax Americana, from China's reform and opening, from the rise of middle powers, and the progressive integration of ASEAN. In fact, Singapore thrived as a global metropolis in an age of globalization. Now, the first brutal hard truth is that if that period has ended, we cannot simply presume that if we just carry on as per normal, somehow, magically, things will fall into place. This is a moment of rupture. It's also worth asking ourselves why and how that benign era of globalization has ended. Actually, foreign policy begins at home, and this applies in understanding what is happening now on the global stage. In many countries, there has been a populist backlash. Globalization has created wealth, but it is also blamed for accentuating fault lines, for increasing inequality, for middle-class stagnation, for the loss of jobs, for growing despair and depolarization in many societies. This domestic dysfunction has now projected itself onto the global stage, and you'll see that this has undermined the support for the international order. So I completely agree with Mr. Yip Hong Wing, Mr. Vikram Nair, Mr. Liang Ying Hua, and Gerald Giam, that this is not a passing shower. This is not just a small tremor. This is geostrategic tectonic plate rupture. The Greek historian Thucydides wrote, "The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must." His words are now acutely apt today. The great powers flex their military and economic power more readily than ever before in pursuit of their interests more narrowly defined. And to be frank, with less pretense of legal or moral justification for their actions. Where there was once economic integration, there is now fragmentation and weaponization of interdependence and dependence. We are now in a world where international relations are no longer driven primarily by rules or by attempts to achieve consensus. Actually, the great powers have always been selective when applying the rule of law to themselves. But now they feel even less need to engage in hypocrisy. It's all about raw power and how that raw power asymmetry can be exploited. And so this is a far more dangerous world for small countries, because small countries do not have the strategic heft to buffer ourselves from turbulence. For Singapore, a tiny city state, the shoals are even more treacherous. Let's pause for a moment to consider what our options are. Option number one, despair, give up, surrender to our fates. I think the answer must be no, because that's not who we are. This is not who we were in 1965, when in fact a newly independent Singapore faced even longer odds with less resources. Second option, choose one dominant power and seek protection under its wing. No. This would undermine our sovereignty, our independence, and in effect make us a vassal state. Singapore should not and does not need to do this. And after all, Singapore has never expected anyone else to come to our defense. We will defend ourselves. The third, and in my view, the only viable option for us, is to continue to determine our long-term national interests and then exercise our agency to chart our own path, choose our own destiny. Yes, we may be small, but we are a sovereign and independent country. We are a trusted global hub and an assiduous bridge builder. We want to make common cause with all states that are willing to engage us. We build regional and global networks that support dialogue, openness, and inclusion. We want to be useful, but not made use of. We are successful because of our domestic unity, our economic relevance and vitality, and our defense capability. So therefore, we may be small, but we have agency, we have resilience, and we have the resources and the will to back this up. Ms. Lim Hong Wing asked how Singapore will defend our principles, not just in words, but also in deed. Singapore's foreign policy has always rested on two pillars. Mr. Rajaratnam described the first pillar as the theology of foreign policy. Theology. That means the world that we hope to have, a world that hopefully was based on principles of fairness, sovereign equality, and international rules. But we have never been naive. There is a deep vein of realism in the way we view the world and the way we operate. And this is what Mr. Rajaratnam termed, quote, the practice of foreign policy. Now, we have always understood that size and power matter in foreign relations. Disagreement, coercion, even conflict are part and parcel of the cut and thrust of international relations. And this is precisely why we have spent between 3 to 6% of our GDP for six decades for defense. An effective foreign policy needs both pillars, idealism and realism. We never want to become so cynical that no one will trust us. But we also do not want to be so naive that we will get taken advantage of by everyone. So we need to assess objectively our national interests based on our unique circumstances as a tiny multiracial city-state in the heart of Southeast Asia. So, the next set of questions, what are our national interests? First, to safeguard our sovereignty, our independence, and our national unity. Second, to secure access to essential supplies and the freedom of navigation necessary for us to continue to have access to these essential supplies. What are these essential supplies? Energy, food, water, and you can add to that list. The third national interest is to continue to strengthen our role as a trusted global hub for trade, for finance, for wealth management, advanced manufacturing, and other global services. And fourth aspect of our national interest is to support a rules-based multilateral approach wherever possible, recognizing that the challenges to the global commons, like climate change, like pandemics, in fact, have to be tackled collectively because they go beyond the ability of any single country, even a superpower, to resolve. So in such a tumultuous world, the point I'm making today is that we are going to face more strategic dilemmas and difficult choices. Because, for instance, our interests are not always going to be aligned with the great powers, or the middle powers, or our immediate neighbours. On some issues, and this is the key point I'm making today, on some issues we will have to say no. To say no courteously, respectfully, and constructively, but nevertheless, to stand firm and say no. And this is not about choosing sides, but about upholding principles and a careful assessment of Singapore's long-term national interests. Now, I've been in this post long enough to tell you that pressure has been and will be brought to bear on us. And there will always be attempts to weaken our will and to divide us domestically. And I would also state that sometimes we will pay a price for staking out our position. But I'm hoping that this House and the citizens beyond will agree that we must retain this ability to say no when we have to, and that if we ever lose that ability to say no, then that is the day that Singapore loses its relevance, indeed our independence. Let's provide some examples, so it's not just words. We have consistently called out violations of international law. We did so when Russia invaded Ukraine. To us, that was a clear violation of international law and the principles of the UN Charter. More recently, we also did so in relation to the US actions in Venezuela. And we took these positions because a world based on might is right is a world that's more dangerous for Singapore. We spoke out about the need to preserve a rules-based trading system, including the principle of most favored nation in the WTO. We expressed categorically our disappointment with the US tariffs that violate this principle, because trade is our lifeblood. Trade is more than three times Singapore's GDP. Jobs, investments, and living standards depend on our predictable access to external markets. We also took clear positions on the Israel-Gaza conflict. We condemned the attacks that occurred on the 7th of October 2023 on Israel. These were acts of terror. We affirmed that every state has a right of self-defense. However, in exercising this right, countries must abide by international law, including international humanitarian law. And we have clearly stated that Israel's military response has breached international humanitarian law. I agree with Mr. Yip Hong Wing on the need for both moral clarity and diplomatic effectiveness. Although I would add that we mustn't try to reduce foreign relations into a morality play. I think you will be hard-pressed to find occasions when the Prime Minister or me ever refer to anyone, any other leader or any other country as evil or saint. That's not the way things work in real life. Coming back to Gaza, we have and we will do more to alleviate the suffering in Gaza. And in fact, we have been able to do more precisely because We've got extensive diplomatic ties across the entire Middle East, and we're one of the few countries, and those of you who travel with me will know, with remarkable access to all sites. We have sent 11 tranches of humanitarian aid amounting to more than 25 million Singapore dollars to help the civilians in Gaza so far, and you know that these fundraising efforts are continuing, and more than just money, that there are Singaporeans lining up to volunteer their services, their professional services, to help on the ground. To answer Mr. Gerald Giam, we are still assessing the invitation from the US to formally join the Board of Peace. But in the meantime, we will explore initiatives, including those that were recently announced at the inaugural meeting of the Board of Peace on the 19th of February 2026. Singapore will continue to play a constructive role in the pursuit of peace and reconstruction in Gaza. And on Palestine, the larger question, our long-standing position remains that the only path to a just and durable peace is a negotiated two-state solution consistent with the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. We oppose attempts to create new facts on the ground that undermine the prospects for a two-state solution. And it is our consistent position that the Israeli settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law. These positions that we have taken and explicitly stated over the last few years have not been universally welcome, and even domestically have elicited active debate. But the point I'm trying to make to you is that people may disagree with certain decisions and positions that we take, but I hope you understand why we take these positions, as Mr. Fu Chaxiang has emphasized. Taking a position rather than lying low and seeking cover, in fact, aligns with furthering our national interests. Articulating these positions is part of exercising agency, because we must try to shape the environment and to carve out conditions which are most conducive for the survival and success of small states. I agree with Mr. Giam that in this fraught geopolitical environment, the personal touch is still of paramount. Building relationships at a personal level between leaders, political leaders, is still the paramount currency of diplomacy. Last year, MFA facilitated over 180 visits, incoming and outgoing, at the political level. If you include officials and civil servants, the number balloons exponentially. But the purpose of meeting, of traveling, is not just to show up, just to fly the flag, but to deepen the personal rapport and trust between leaders and officials and their foreign counterparts, particularly when the views are divergent. It won't resolve the conflict, but building reservoirs of trust and understanding reduces the probability of miscommunications and unnecessary conflicts. Having said all that, if we go one more layer of resolution down, MFA has five priority work streams. First, we want to engage all the great powers constructively, and we want to give them a stake in the stability and prosperity of our region, because that balance of power between great powers is what gives small states like Singapore room for maneuver and options. The second work stream is to buttress an even wider network of middle power partnerships for greater stability. I think in the last couple of years, the need for middle powers, particularly middle powers who share an affinity for international law, multilateralism, free trade, the imperative for middle powers to get together and for us to engage the middle powers has become all the more obvious. Our third work stream is to strengthen a stable and integrated ASEAN, because not just because it's our immediate neighbourhood, but because this happens to be a part of the world with great potential over the next couple of decades, in terms of economic growth, in terms of a rising middle class, in terms of technological leapfrogging, in terms of infrastructure and integration. Fourth, obviously, we do need to pay attention to our immediate neighbours. And by our immediate neighbours, it's Malaysia, Indonesia, Brunei, the core of our core. And fifth, take an overarching view, we need where we can to reinforce a rules-based international architecture despite the current headwinds. So again, it's an example of not surrendering to our fates. Let me delve in a little bit more detail about the major powers, starting with the US and China. Mr. Edward Chia, Henry Kwek, Yip Hong Wing, Ms. Sean Huang, Ms. Jessica Tan asked, how do we maintain trust with both the US and China whilst preserving Singapore's strategic options, and even while the two powers, superpowers, are competing against each other in the realms of security, supply chains, technology, and trade? It's a tough question. Well, let me start with the US. We have a substantial, deep, and multifaceted relationship with the US. The US has long been and continues to be the largest foreign investor in Singapore by a long way. If you check the figures, you will see that it is multiple times more stock of FDI from the US than the second, third, fourth, and fifth investor, even if you add it up. We purchase US defense equipment, and we cooperate closely on countering terrorism and proliferation. And we are deepening our cooperation in critical and emerging technologies. This year, we celebrate 60 years of diplomatic ties with the US. Having said that, China is also a vital partner with whom we enjoy a robust and close relationship. Over most of the last 10 years, China has been our largest trading partner in goods. At the last Joint Council for Bilateral Cooperation, we concluded 27 agreements ranging from finance and innovation to food security and green energy. We marked 35 years of diplomatic relations last year. Actually, if you stop to think about it, beyond the numbers, we have a unique relationship with China. China and Singapore are the only two sovereign states in the world with a majority Chinese population, with deep linguistic, cultural, and historical links. This presents both opportunities and is also a burden for us, because Singapore is an independent, multiracial city-state in the heart of Southeast Asia. We have our own identity, our own political system, and our own values. Actually, our value proposition, even to China, is to be same-same but different, to quote Mr. Lim Swee Say. Same-same, yes, of course we enjoy the affinity, the linguistic, the shared cultural heritage. But different because Singapore's destiny and our value proposition is to be distinct and not yet another small Chinese city. Do you see my point? So therefore, we have to work with both the US and China where our interests coincide. And where our interests diverge, we will have to courteously stand up and say no. And when we say no, both sides must understand it's not personal, but it's based on a principled assessment of Singapore's national interests, and that we are not acting as a proxy for one or the other against them. So long as we can maintain this, and I speak now from experience, in fact, so long as we maintain this principled approach, actually I feel that we come under less pressure, because they know this tiny little city-state is one where the more you push them, the more spine, and the more firmly they will hold their ground. And conducting foreign policy on this basis with superpowers, I'm telling you from experience, I think this is the only way to do it. The reality is that all countries, including Singapore, will have to find creative ways to work with both the US and China, because they are the major powers and they are relevant to our future. Turning to the middle powers, we are growing our network of partnerships with middle powers and with regional blocs. So, for instance, in 2025, we upgraded our partnerships with Australia, France, India, New Zealand, Vietnam. We achieved a new partnership with South Korea. We signed the EU-Singapore Digital Trade Agreement, and we are deepening relations with more like-minded partners. We are expanding our global footprint in Africa and Latin America. And to support this, we are establishing new missions in Mexico and Ethiopia. And actually, there will be more to come. And I want to reassure Mr. Lee Hong Chuan that all these moves will, beyond the diplomatic field, are also aimed to increase access for our local enterprises to overseas markets. On ASEAN, I agree with Mr. Liang Eng Hua and Ms. Valerie Lee that ASEAN has to remain the cornerstone of our foreign policy. It is a salient platform from which we engage the wider world. For ASEAN to remain relevant, you have reminded us that we must deepen our regional integration in order to become more cohesive, more united, and credible. An integrated ASEAN builds a stable regional platform for Singapore and gives us a voice, more so than a unilateral voice, and also the convening power of ASEAN. And that's why we're also pushing very hard on key initiatives that bind our ASEAN economies closer together, as emphasized by Mr. Yip Hong Wing and Ms. Rachel Ong. We are making progress on the ASEAN power grid. This is about creating a sustainable, interconnected infrastructure that supports the entire region's growth. The ASEAN Digital Economy Framework Agreement was substantially concluded last year. We hope to finalize the agreement this year. I believe it will unlock the immense potential of the digital economy in ASEAN in the years to come. But we must also continue to look outwards. We should give all major powers a stake in the stability and prosperity of our region and to ensure that ASEAN remains a partner of choice. This is the logic behind our open, inclusive, ASEAN-centered regional architecture. The more countries invest in ASEAN's collective progress, the more stable we will be. This balance of power and interests provides small countries like Singapore with more room for maneuver than an alternative scenario where there was only a single power dominating our region. Mr. Gerald Giam, Mr. Patrick Tay, Ms. Rachel Ong asked how we plan to leverage our upcoming ASEAN chairmanship to deepen integration and unity. We will assume the chair of ASEAN in 2027 during ASEAN's 60th anniversary. This is a heavy responsibility, but also an opportunity at a time of tumult. We will deepen integration, we will promote external partnerships, we will continue to keep the ASEAN region open for business, open to the world, committed to peace, stability, and cooperation. I would like to assure Mr. Gerald Giam that we do, in fact, second offices to the ASEAN Secretariat, particularly at the leadership positions. We've done so over the years, including the current Deputy Secretary General for the ASEAN Economic Community, Mr. Satbinder Singh. MFA will continue to curate and facilitate secondments for MFA and other public officers from other ministries to the ASEAN Secretariat and to other international organizations. This extends our experience and knowledge base of international diplomacy and tradecraft more widely across our civil service. Let me turn now to our neighbors, closer to home. Strong relations with Malaysia, with Indonesia and Brunei is critical. Mr. Patrick Tay asked how we will step up our engagement with them. Mr. Victor Lai asked how we will strengthen economic coordination with our neighbours through city-based and regional partnerships, given the increasing cross-border activities of Singaporean companies and Singaporeans. With Indonesia, we have resolved long-standing issues and are now in a position to explore mutually beneficial projects in energy, in food security, education, and healthcare. We are discussing cross-border electricity trade, carbon capture and storage, and establishing a sustainable industrial zone across the Batam-Bintan-Karimun corridor. These strategic projects will accelerate decarbonization. It will catalyze green investments in both countries. And we look forward to commemorating 60 years of diplomatic ties in 2027. With Malaysia, our leaders meet regularly, both formally and informally, for candid discussions. This has allowed us to pursue beneficial regional partnerships, including the Johor-Singapore Special Economic Zone, the Johor-Bahru-Singapore Rapid Transit System Link. We are deepening economic and people-to-people ties with East Malaysia. In fact, we will be establishing new consulates, one in Sabah and one in Sarawak, shortly. But at the same time, I will also be candid and tell you that we are trying to manage outstanding bilateral issues that are complex, that by definition have been around for a long time, and will take time to resolve. But the fact of the matter is Malaysia, Indonesia, and Brunei will always be close neighbours, permanent neighbours. And we cannot afford to allow spiky issues to undermine our overall positive cooperation. On international organizations, norms, and standards, I agree with Ms. Sip Hong Wing, Mr. Lee Hong Chuan, on the need to protect the global commons and to support multilateralism. Despite the challenges, the rules-based multilateral system ultimately provides the architecture of norms, standards, and institutions that protects the global commons and gives all small states a say. So this means, in spite of the headwinds today, we must continue to do our best to build overlapping, flexible circles of plurilateral partnerships with like-minded countries. Wherever we can make common cause, we do so and we proceed. We remain fully committed to the World Trade Organization, but achieving consensus amongst 166 members is very difficult. Our strategy is to push the envelope with like-minded partners where we can, who share our commitment to free trade, and we aim for high ambition agreements that are inclusive and WTO consistent so that others can join when ready. In other words, make common cause, move forward, invite other people to come on board, always stay open and inclusive. The joint statement initiative on e-commerce agreement began with Singapore, Australia, and Japan. It now has 72 co-sponsors. The future of investment and trade partnership brings together 16 small and medium-sized economies on supply chain resilience and trade facilitation. Do you see my point? These are examples where you start small, but you can build and expand these platforms. Beyond trade, we have also built constituencies of support amongst fellow small states in the UN. The Forum of Small States, which Singapore co-founded, brings together 108 countries to address issues like sustainable development, climate change, protecting the global commons, and digitalization. Building consensus in a fractured world is difficult, but not impossible. Ambassador Rena Lee presided over the conclusion of the BBNJ agreement in 2023. We will continue to contribute where we can. And our nomination of Ambassador Rena Lee as a candidate for judge in the International Court of Justice reflects our commitment to advancing the international rule of law. Mr. Neo Kok-beng has suggested leveraging technology as a soft power. Completely agree with you. We have, in fact, been stepping up technology cooperation in partnership with other countries. We work together with others, including at the G20 and APEC, to shape the norms and standards, and more importantly, open access to technology that can benefit all countries. We will continue to strengthen such engagements and ensure that Singapore remains an open and trusted hub for technological innovation and scientific collaboration. I tell my foreign counterparts, send your people to us. We will run an open book exercise with you. We will show you how we do it. Because anyway, the challenge is not in the idea. The challenge is in execution. And to the extent that we can show people what we've done, including our mistakes, and they can modify it and make it relevant to them, that's how we exercise thought leadership and cooperation in this field. Let me come to the challenges ahead. We're in a very turbulent world. We will face more inflection points, and we will have to take more difficult positions. Singaporeans will have different views on these foreign policy issues. Being interested, or as Eileen has said, literate in global issues, and understanding Singapore's national interests will help us engage the world with knowledge, understanding, and confidence. We do not necessarily have to agree on all our foreign policy stances, but we must agree that these are matters to be discussed and decided by Singaporeans alone. And that means keeping a wary eye on foreign interference and influence. With increased global contestation, foreign actors will want us to align with their views. They will try to seed their narratives. And there will be attempts, as have occurred more recent times, to create fake news and to play on potential internal divisions. We have already seen information campaigns targeting Singapore online, including, I must add, during our own general elections last year, where Singaporeans were urged to vote along religious lines. Government statements on regional developments have prompted criticisms from foreign netizens who want us to adopt their interpretations of history. And such attempts will continue. Geopolitical contestation has become a tussle for the hearts and minds in cyberspace as well. We must be aware and we must exercise caution because we have a diverse population. And never presume that we are immune to the polarization and fractures in societies elsewhere. So where does this leave us? The world today, more dangerous, more unpredictable than I've ever seen in my decade plus as foreign minister. The global order that used to underpin our success has ended, and we do not expect a stable new equilibrium to take shape in 2026 or even, frankly, even the next couple of years. And we must expect more issues on which we will have to take a difficult stand. And external and domestic pressures on us will grow. But I also believe we should take heart. The challenges we face today are serious, but they are less severe than what Singapore faced in 1965. Singapore had unexpectedly become independent. We had no hinterland, no resources, no armed forces. Our security was precarious. Our economic viability was in doubt. Our social cohesion was yet to be forged, and we lived in a volatile and dangerous neighbourhood that regarded us with suspicion. Despite all this, our pioneers pressed ahead, and they built this country. This is a narrative that connects Singapore over the decades. We may be small and improbable, but we have never been afraid to stand up to fight for what we believe in. Today, we are in a far, far better position in terms of tools and resources. We have three prerequisites for success. The first is our domestic unity, although this is work always, constantly in progress. As long as we understand that we are all in this together, as long as we can inoculate ourselves from foreign influence, as long as we can disagree maturely and ultimately still forge a domestic consensus, we will continue to thrive and we cannot be bought or bullied by anyone. The second ingredient is our economic vitality and relevance. Mr. Lee Kuan Yew said, quote, "Singapore cannot take its relevance for granted. Small countries perform no vital or irreplaceable function in the international system, unquote. Hence, we must preserve our relevance to the world. In 1965, our per capita GDP was US $500. Today, it is over US $90,000. Paradoxically, today's more fractious world accentuates Singapore's value as a trusted, stable hub. Our friends and partners know that we speak honestly and independently. They know that we are open and welcoming to all. They know that we honour our word. Contracts are sacrosanct. Investments and intellectual capital are protected. There is a premium in such a world for stability, consistency, and respect for the rule of law. The third ingredient is our ability to defend ourselves. We can do that today because we have national service and because of the steady investment in defence for decades. We must preserve this capability because it keeps us safe, and we are a country that can hope for the best, but also prepare for the worst. So on this note, I thank all members for your long-standing support for MFA's work as we continue to navigate the challenges, we continue to safeguard Singapore's national interests, and we seize the opportunities in these troubled times. I began with Thucydides and the cold logic of power. I'll end on a different note. The ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus offered a different kind of wisdom. Quote, "Character is destiny," unquote. For all the turbulence in the world, I believe Singapore's destiny is bright, not because of our size or our luck, but because of who we are. That Singapore spirit, indomitable grit, courage, honesty, discipline, diligence, rectitude, and compassion. These are not mere abstractions. This is the Singapore spirit that got us here, and it is what will carry us forward. Thank you.